welcome to Interchain FM, where we dive into the frontier of the blockchain space. We're now in the third generation of blockchain tech, where a burgeoning multi-chain ecosystem is about to explode into what we call the decentralized web. Where Ethereum is to the mainframe computing era of the internet, Cosmos is to the PC era. If you're seeking alpha in the Cosmos ecosystem, look no further. This is the destination for your exponential learning experience. Interchain FM is where you can get the download on all of the high signal projects building bridges to one another and how you can participate in the future of the internet.
I'm with Haseeb from Dragonfly Capital, and you're one of the first investors on this podcast, I would say.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like everybody in crypto is an investor in their own way, though.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's all money, right? So, like, we're here to invest.
Yeah. I mean, we're all degens.
We're all degens deep down. We're just more institutional degen.
Yes. So what's life like in the institutional degen world?
Well, I mean, after Sam fucked everything up, things have been kind of slow.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't a lot of people raising money after FTX collapsed.
Yeah.
So things are pretty quiet. But, you know, things are picking up again. Obviously, crypto's up like 2x from the lows. And I feel like energy's starting to come back.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of antsiness around, hey, the SEC is getting super aggressive. Like, it seems like things are, in the U.S. at least, the regulatory environment is not looking super great.
Yeah.
But globally, you know, I was just in Asia for like about half the year I've been in Asia, like in Singapore and in Hong Kong. I was just in the Middle East about a month ago. And globally, it's kind of a different picture than what you see here in the
What's
U.S.
What's going on there?
They're being in the Middle East.
Yeah, and other parts of the world where it's
well,
not...
Well, so Hong Kong right now, I mean, there's all this hullabaloo about Hong Kong opening back up the digital assets.
Right.
After China banned crypto in 2021.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden they're 360-ing, or I get 180-ing?
180.
Whatever, yeah, it's 180. Well, 360 if you think long enough.
Yes.
So they basically...
They're going to revert back to banning it again?
Well, no, I mean 360 from when it was not banned.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, regardless of where you start the rotation, they're back, and I think they're going to open up retail trading on June 1st.
Oh,
so
wow.
All of a sudden, you know, there was a big conference about a month ago, actually no, about a couple weeks ago in Hong Kong.
What's it called?
It was a HashKey conference. I don't remember the name, but it was like a big Web3 whatever conference.
Yeah, I was invited to that.
A lot of people went.
They flew all the way to Hong Kong for that.
Yeah, just for that. And it was the biggest Web3 conference in Asia in years.
Yeah.
And people from
that was sponsored
Beijing
by Wang Chung,
there.
Right?
Wang Chung, yeah. That's the company behind HashKey.
Yeah.
So people from Beijing were there, basically like softly nodding and saying like, yes, this is good. People should come back. It was actually just, I think, earlier this week that HKMA, which is the regulator in Hong Kong, basically ordered the Hong Kong banks to allow Web3 companies to open bank accounts in Hong Kong, which is like fucking crazy.
What do you think caused the change of mind? Or was it an opportunistic thing where they saw what's happening in the U.S. and they're like, okay, time to take back the reins?
It's not the U.S. They maybe a little bit care about the U.S., but mostly they care about Singapore. So Hong Kong and Singapore, they're kind of like brothers, but Hong Kong was always the older brother and Singapore was the younger brother. And then during COVID, Hong Kong basically became super Chinese and like did super intense lockdowns, didn't allow any travel, whereas Singapore opened up early and they were like, look, we're going to take on a little bit more risk because we want to bring in business. And so a bunch of people, especially during the Shanghai lockdowns, left mainland China, and instead of just going to Hong Kong where they normally go, Hong Kong was also locked down, they went to Singapore. So Singapore had a huge influx of capital, huge influx of people from mainland China, huge influx of, you know, Web3 startups that left Hong Kong and went into Singapore. And now that China's opened back up again, or at least Hong Kong has opened up, they're like, shit, we lost the lead. Hong Kong used to be like the New York City of Asia.
Yeah.
And now that's Singapore. So Hong Kong is fighting to win that spot back. And they see Web3 as part of that strategy to like win that center of gravity, which they used to have.
Yeah.
You know, FTX used to be in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
BitMEX was in Hong Kong. OKX was in Hong Kong. All the big exchanges were in Hong Kong. Now almost nobody is there.
Yeah.
It's a small set of stragglers who are left in Hong Kong. So Hong Kong's trying to win that back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way that China looks at this is that China thinks like, look, we overreacted a bit on the crypto thing. Like, I know that we were really intense. Yeah, like, guys, look, mea culpa.
Yeah, I know we called all the Bitcoin miners to Beijing headquarters and told them shut down.
Yeah, exactly. But like, look, this Web3 thing, this metaverse stuff, maybe it goes somewhere. We don't want to be totally averse to it. So we'll kind of sandbox it, put it in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is where all the like, degenerates are anyway, and like it's a way to ring fence it as well from Chinese retail.
Mm.
Because Chinese retail, You know, in China, they call it the Lao Bai Xing, the sort of the common people. The common people are like, look, we don't want them to get scammed. We don't want them to get fleeced. We don't want you to like fuck up with, you know, fuck their shit up. Right. But the rich people in Hong Kong and the local Hong Kongese were, you know, like 8 million people. It's not that many people. You can mess with them. Right. So like they are grown-ups. They can handle it.
You mean is that kind of like the accredited investor sort of mentality?
A little bit. So the thing is, like, Hong Kong, the actual local Hong Kongers are, you know, it's like one city. It's not that big. Mm. The thing about Hong Kong is that it has, like, if you are wealthy in China, you have capital in Hong Kong. So it's basically a way of saying rich people and, you know, the degenerates in Hong Kong, yeah, they can play with crypto. But the normal people in China can't talk.
How come Lao Ban Xing can't do that?
So the reason why is that, look, if you remember in, I think it was late 2020, that Xi Jinping announced the Blockchain Plus initiative. You remember this? Where basically they were like, blockchain is systemically important strategic initiative for China. Yeah. And there was an article in the People's Daily, which is like the government-backed newspaper, that basically said, Bitcoin and Ethereum are fantastic innovations. They're great financial technology, which was like crazy. Because before that, China was always like, this stuff is shady, this stuff is bad, you shouldn't touch it. And then all of a sudden, I remember we had an associate on our team, and she'd been working in crypto since like 2016, 2017. And her parents were always like kind of disappointed in her that she was working in the shady industry.
It's like working in the cannabis industry. I got that from my parents.
Yeah, Asian parents, right? So totally. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so after the Blockchain Plus initiative was announced, her parents called her and was like, oh, we never understood that what you were doing was for the good of China.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was like a real sea change in China. Like, universities started teaching blockchain classes, which they never did before that. Like, it became a respectable thing to do.
Right.
Then, in 2021, they banned crypto, right? Now, why did they ban crypto in 2021? When in 2019, they were like, it's super important. And the answer is not that China doesn't like crypto. Like that, I think it's a little too specific. It's rather that China does not like disorder. And crypto bull markets are really fucking disorderly, right? It's like people jumping from the rafters, throwing crazy parties, scamming grandmothers, doing like NFT rug pulls. Like that stuff, China does not like that. China's like, pipe down. Like that's way, way too much. You guys are getting too rowdy, okay? We're now way more bull, you know, bear market vibes. Things are more chill. Things are moving more slowly. And China's like, okay, cool. Now that you calm down, you can have Hong Kong and like show me a little something that like you guys can handle this. And if you can, then maybe we'll consider opening back up the mainland to crypto again.
Right.
That's the vibe that I get of what's going on in Hong Kong.
Okay. Wow. China is truly the big brother.
They are truly the big brother.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought that the whole country was born out of chaos. I mean, it's a very chaotic country anyway.
One might argue that's why the government needs to impose so much order. Is that it is intrinsically a very chaotic country.
Right. Yeah, right. That's why it's so draconian, because for some reason, the culture doesn't say that, hey, don't, you know, like open your toddler's, you know, butt flap and like let him shit on the streets, you know. They need to apply social credit in order to prevent that.
Maybe, I don't know if that's the reason why, but maybe that's part of the story.
I heard.
I don't know anything about infants and butt flaps, but I do know, China, for one, they love gambling.
Right.
So that is definitely true, right? So yeah, like, I mean, you remember the gaming regulations in China, where they basically clamped down massively on the gaming industry.
Mm.
Part of the reason for that is that like Chinese teenagers are just total degenerates, and they will just like spend all their time on these games and just spend like shitloads of money and waste away their lives.
Oh yeah. From what I hear, the biggest WoW gold miners are also Chinese.
Of course. Yeah. I don't doubt it.
Like, something about the culture. They just love like farming or mining.
They do. And the thing too is like, the other thing to understand about China is that China, like from the West, we often think of China as being like, they're all Chinese. Of course, China, like even the language Chinese, which what we call Chinese is Mandarin,
yeah,
right? Which is like the official language of China. But China has like 70 different languages that are spoken in different provinces.
Mm-hmm.
And Mandarin is like the very educated language that you speak in sort of like, you know, official tones when you want to sound respectable. But most places in China, they speak totally different languages. They have very different kinds of food. China was a conquered country of like many different ethnicities and provinces that were brought together under a central government that has now become very strong. But historically, China was like a bunch of different things, like, you know, like Tibet and Mongolia and all these places that are part of China that, of course, have very different cultures and very different backgrounds.
Right.
Like there's a lot of parts of China that are Muslim, a lot of parts of China that are basically ethnically Russian.
Oh, yeah, right.
So, like, China is a really big, complicated place. And that's part of the reason why the central government does so much work to try to, you know, standardize China as best they can.
Sure.
It doesn't always work, but they try their best.
Fair.
So anyway, not to be a China shill. To be clear, I'm not a China shill, but
just trying to
give some context about why China has such a complicated relationship with crypto. All right.
We've got Goon in the house.
Goon, hey. You made it. Come join us. We're already recording. So here's the important question. Is Atom a meme token?
I do not think so.
Atom is kind of a meme token.
Kind of a meme token?
Really?
It isn't everything at some level.
Fair enough.
Is AVAX a meme token?
No. My biggest competitor is a freaking dog, right?
That's your biggest competitor?
Well, it's not, but it's my next competitor. Like, it's so silly.
Oh, like on CoinMarketCap. That's
the next thing. CoinMarketCap. Okay, like, we're just like around the freaking dog.
Yeah.
So,
the dog has done very well.
And that dog's doing incredibly well.
My thesis is that Dogecoin is the real silver to Bitcoin's gold.
You think so?
Instead of Litecoin.
Not wrong.
Litecoin is definitely not silver. Litecoin is definitely not silver.
Yeah, definitely.
Same code base. Yeah, not Litecoin. Yeah, Doge.
Yeah.
Gold and silver do have the same code base.
Yeah, silver is supposed to have more money velocity than gold, and
Dogecoin
is more liquid than Litecoin, for sure.
Well, I mean, that's because Litecoin is dead.
Yes.
Litecoin is number 30 now? Number 40?
Something really like
that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's relegated to being the, I don't know, like the security budget for Dogecoin, essentially.
Or Dogecoin.
Yeah, this is merging.
But didn't Litecoin ship a bunch of stuff like privacy or like Mimblewimble or something?
No,
they talked about Mimblewimble. I don't know if
it actually did it.
I don't think they actually.
Yeah, they're just stranded without Charlie Liu.
Like,
he was such a great leader.
Who wants privacy preservation? Does anyone?
No clue.
Yeah,
no clue. All right. We're going to turn this into the Litecoin community update.
Yes, Litecoin Shill podcast. Yeah, you're
Litecoin
right.
Litecoin Shill podcast.
So Mimblewimbles are good too.
They've been waiting for a while for a community update. Finally, we can provide that. All right.
Haseeb was talking about the Middle East and things going on in China, and we were just talking about crypto macro. I mean, what do you see?
So you've been spending a lot of time in Korea.
I've spent a lot of time in Korea. Just got back from there. And Korea is fantastic as a bellwether for what's going to happen in the U.S. as soon as we have some regulatory clarity. So these guys are far ahead of us. They are perfectly okay with coins themselves. They are now sorting out the regulation around securities tokens, but they're so comfortable with tokens that they're just doing a hell of a lot with a lot of institutional interest in tokenizing actual assets that they have. So I had the best time there. There was a lot of institutional interest. We ended up inking a bunch of deals. One of them was made public with SK Planet. It's, they're doing this tokenization of loyalty points, 22 million users, these like things that people use to buy lunch, et cetera, et cetera. So these are actual real use cases, and the regulation is clear, and they're doing it. And
I just saw the Korean High Court just ruled that Luna is not a security.
They did?
Really?
Yeah. You guys didn't see this?
No.
I think it was why Daniel Shin. So Daniel Shin was indicted, I think, by the Korean prosecutors.
Yeah.
And something about the indictment was not valid because he was ruled not to be in violation of securities laws because Luna was not a security.
Well, what does that make Dokwon?
An asshole. I mean, he's still committed fraud, right? He still committed fraud.
Well, what was the fraud exactly?
What's the fraud?
The fraud was around Chai, right? Oh. So I don't know if you guys actually. So I read through the entire indictment because I have too much free time.
Yeah.
And the indictment basically stated. So I don't know if you guys followed the SEC lawsuit. Basically, the SEC lawsuit against Dokwon said that they claimed for a long time that Chai was the initial use case for Terra that was galvanizing a lot of its adoption.
Okay.
That was all fake. Chai never used Terra. And what they did is they had a bot that they ran on Terra to basically look at the activity on Chai and copy it using bots on Terra to make it look like Chai was settling transactions on Terra when no such thing was ever happening.
I see.
Chai was all Web 2. It was traditional payment rail. And so Chai never actually claimed that they were using Luna, but Luna claimed that Chai was using Luna.
I see.
And so they both intentionally fabricated this activity, represented it to investors and to the public.
Got it.
So this was the most obvious. Now, to be clear, the SEC thinks Luna is a security, but the Korean High Court does not.
I can see why the Koreans would not. And that whole Luna thing is I don't know where to say.
What do the Koreans think about it?
They're actually kind of living through trauma. No, I think they almost never came up. almost never came up. In some discussions we had
with some
official government people, it was brought up as, you know, we want to avoid this kind of thing.
Oh.
And it's just been, it's just...
So I heard, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that, like, although Do Kwon was Korean,
mm-hmm.
Luna did not have that much traction in Korea, that most of their traction was international, and, like, especially actually in the U.S.
Yep.
That a lot...
Most of it in anger?
In where?
In anger.
Yes, yes, yes.
And anger, yeah.
Basically, I mean, obviously, interest rates in the U.S. were super low at that
sure.
time.
Yeah.
So people were like, oh, my God, I can get 20% on cash.
Right.
Pretty amazing.
Yep.
And whereas in Korea... what I heard is that Korea loves like these like super random shit coins, mm-hmm. basically. And like mostly homegrown shit coins that nobody outside of Korea has ever heard of.
Right.
And they do the most volume on Upbit. That's what I've heard. Now, to be clear, I'm secondhand, third hand.
Sure.
But this is what I've heard.
Okay.
Korea is kind of a strange market relative to most crypto markets.
Yeah, it's actually a bit more nuanced. Yeah. But even Koreans, even as they like their own local coins, they actually understand the difference between the parochial Korean market-oriented local coins versus the global market. And it's very different. The way they treat them is different. And they do flip the Korean coins a lot, but they see the other ones as more investment.
Right.
So, but, you know, overall, it was so fun to see a hell of a lot of serious people.
Mm.
You know, these are people with careers, etc. People from banks, people from large corporations wanting to use blockchain, wanting to have tokenized solutions. So great. And that's exactly what's going to happen the moment we have some clarity in the US. And, you know, I didn't get into this business to build like reflexive tokens and, you know, whatever, like unsustainable yields and so forth. I got into it so that, you know, we'd actually build real rails. And so they're beginning to do that. We're beginning to do that there. And hopefully we'll have some clarity in the US and we'll be able to do the same with our tokens here.
Yeah.
Predictions. What do you think is going to happen to Do Kwon?
Prison?
You think? Prison?
Yes, like, very definitely.
I heard that he was given a life sentence. You think it's going to be that?
Well, he's definitely not been sentenced to anything yet. I mean, he hasn't even been extradited as far as I know.
Okay.
I think he's still in Montenegro.
I've heard like they want to, there's like something.
They want to throw the book at him, of course.
Right. The book at him.
Yeah.
I think that's excessive. I mean, we've seen people engage in absolute horrendous fraud.
Yeah.
And ended up, sure. I didn't know about the Chai story. Sure. I understand that that's fraud. But a lot of the collapse was, I think, something that Do did not anticipate.
I agree with that.
And so, we'll see. I think a life sentence is way too much.
So, I mean, look, even Sam isn't going to get a life sentence, right?
Yeah,
he probably gets like 30, 40 years, maybe.
Sam is just fraud all the way through.
Oh, of course.
Entirely.
But even Sam, I don't think, is going to get a life sentence.
He's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Is he even going to get sentenced? I mean, is he paid up to many? Really, you think so?
Sam? What do you think happens after you run the biggest corporate fraud in the last decade?
He is at home, and I know he's booty calling some girls from home.
He's what?
He's booty. Yeah, there's this one chick. I forget. She's now big on
Twitter. You gotta say her name. Wait, you're talking about Tiffany Fong?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So this girl wants to become famous off of her relationship with SBF, right? Okay. So he's at home.
Wow.
Out on bail without having posted bail or bond, and he's booty calling her. She.
Okay. Well, he's a free man right now, innocent until proven guilty. So.
But I mean, okay. Look, his fraud was arguably more egregious than.
Most
Do's.
Definitely. Most definitely.
Probably arguably.
Do is
getting all worked up right now.
I mean, look. There's some differences. Okay. So for one, Do ran. Okay. Do ran and then like forged documents to like basically try to live on the run. That is very different than what Sam did. And I think courts rightly view that differently.
That
of course. It's like, look, you do a bunch of fucked up stuff and you own up to it. That's going to be treated very differently than you do a bunch of fucked up stuff. You change your identity and you run away to like random tiny European countries. It's just a very different view that you're going to take on that, right? Like Sam just like sat down in Bahamas and waited for people to...
And he said, I'm sorry.
On the other hand, Sam had bought into some really crazy machinery that protected the living shit out of him.
Of course.
And gave him the softest treatment I've seen of any corporate fraudster. What the hell was that? Like the initial New York Times coverage about, is he getting enough sleep? I don't know, but I hope he's not, because I'm not. right? Like, we're all worried about the impact.
To be fair, I think the blame for that falls on the media.
Yes.
Not on Sam. I think the media created Sam.
Oh, he worked those angles, the PR, the connections.
I think by the time that it was that deep, I doubt he was doing anything with the media. He had no idea what was going on.
He had pure calculated.
I mean, when the entire world is collapsing on you, you're not like, oh, what's my media strategy?
I wouldn't put it past them.
If you listen to the stories of people in those last days, it was pure chaos.
Pure chaos. That's
pure
true.
Chaos. That's true. Pure chaos.
That's true.
So, like, I think it was more the media had bought so far into this story that Sam was this beautiful, you know, darling child, that really selfless, egoless man.
Effective altruist.
That they were like, oh, you know, what can you do? Like, oh, this poor guy, he, like, mismanaged a business, and, you know, here's what happened. You try to do a great thing, and the world punishes you. And it was just, obviously...
Such a victim.
The media hates being wrong. They hate being wrong.
Yeah.
And they will fight tooth and nail to not admit they were wrong. No, and
I think there was more there. I think there he ended up purchasing a piece of a machine that exists.
Yeah.
And that machine worked for him, and it was a calculated move. He tried to buy a piece of another machine through his co-founder, through Nikhil, yeah. He bought the Democratic machine. He also wanted to buy into the Republican machine.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it was all pre-calculated.
That's fair.
And he had actual expert help guiding him through this. Like, managing his PR was an amazing job.
Right.
Done right, could only have been done by
pros. Granted, but it wasn't only the New York Times that was softballing here, which tells you that, like, it's the media broadly that was not ready to update.
That's right.
Who Sam was until basically the SEC filed the lawsuit.
Yes, right.
So it took a long time. Same thing with Elizabeth Holmes, right? Like, the media was in denial for a very long time. Although it was, I think, a Washington Post journalist, John Carreyrou, who actually uncovered what happened with Theranos. But it took a long time for the rest of the media to get on board of, like, oh, this young charismatic woman who, like, has the perfect story that we've been building up and reinforcing for a long time is a gigantic corporate fraud.
Yeah.
Yep. Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this podcast to tell you about Interchain FM Steak. Interchain FM is not only a podcast, but also a steakhouse. IFM Steak is a premium sushi-grade steakhouse running on Osmosis, Umi, and Comdex. If you get your alpha from this podcast, show us some love by delegating to Interchain FM Steak. Well, speaking of premeditated and about what caused the initial collapse of Muna and thereby the entire crypto industry therein, what do you think happened there? Are there any theories? Speaking of SBF?
I have a very simple one. I think the Luna collapse was triggered entirely organically by people doing stupid stuff without thinking about the consequences, by people selling, moving too much USD all at once, depegging by mistake. And then after that, there wasn't enough of a response in time, and then everything just kind of unraveled. Huh. People were on edge. The amount of sort of the imbalance in that, you know, the amount of money in the pool versus the amount of assets in the pool was so tipsy anyway that the slightest imbalance ended up pushing everything into a very unstable territory. We know from game theory that these coins only have two equilibria, either at the peg or at zero. They're metastable. The middle does not exist. Right. You can't be like a 60-cent dollar coin, right? What the hell does that mean? Well,
there's ESD that stuck around like 20 cents for a very long time.
That's true. There are some that have been kind of screwed up.
Yeah.
But in general, if you go off the peg, there is there's every reason to go to zero.
If you try to make it back by minting, which is what Luna does.
Oh, yeah, which is what Luna does.
Which ESD does not do that.
Yep. So the only way to actually restore the peg when it's slightly off is if there's somebody on top who is really watching the price like a hawk, and they're engaging in open market operations to try to move it back. And
I thought that was what the protocol was meant
that,
to
do. Well, no, that, but, no, 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 be careful. The protocol gives other people incentives to balance the peg. That's all it does. But that's not quite sufficient for the reasons that Asib brought up. So what you really have to do is, on top of that, when it's just slightly off at 96 cents or so, you have to go in, somebody has to go in and manipulate the price until it's back up to the peg. So these things don't work unless there is an active participant in the markets. And Doe lost it somehow. I don't know what happened, what the timing was. I think somebody moved about 500M all at once, depegged, and then panic ensued, and then bam, it just kind of crashed.
So I think the story, if you zoom in, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, was it Jane Street? Was it Citadel? Was it this thing? Was it that thing? And like, if you zoom out, that doesn't matter. If you zoom out far enough, like, what happened in 2022 broadly? The answer is that interest rates went up, okay? And as interest rates went up, That basically means that prices for things like crypto, risky assets, are going to go down. Okay. And what is Luna at the end of the day? Luna was a leveraged bank. All stablecoins are banks, one way or another. They have assets, they have liabilities. Luna was a leveraged bank. As it gathered more assets, it issued more liabilities, but it took the excess and paid it out to equity holders, which were the people who held Luna, right? So it minted more Terra USD, and then it paid out the excess to equity holders. So it was getting more and more leverage over time, where there's the amount of actual assets in reserve was getting smaller and smaller. Now, they realized this of like, oh, shit, this is like getting way too leveraged. And that's why they did LFT.
Yeah.
Because they basically said, okay, this thing is too leveraged. Let's get some more Bitcoin and like de-lever a little bit. Yep. And everyone was like, oh, that's good. It's good that it's de-levering. But then the Fed hiked interest rates. You know, I think it was like the day before Terra depegged, the Fed hiked again. And all of a sudden, expectation of interest rates went way up from where they were before because inflation was not going down. And so that caused risk assets everywhere to collapse or go down dramatically. Yep. Bitcoin went down 20%. And you could look at the micro and say, oh, this person sold at this time and Curve didn't have enough liquidity, blah, blah, blah. But the main thing is that a leveraged bank, the value of the leverage, like it became more and more levered until people were like, this is too levered.
Yeah.
I want out. Yeah. I don't think I'm going to get my money out. And the thing collapsed.
Yeah.
Of course, if crypto goes down 50%, a bank that's that levered is going to collapse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Same thing happened with SVB.
Yeah.
It's the exact same fucking thing. The value of the assets went down and the value of the equity goes down with it.
Yeah.
And that's why Luna collapsed.
Right. Okay, so, yeah, fair enough.
And there's some value in bringing up some historical similarities. So MakerDAO started with a mechanism very similar to Luna.
Mm.
And they ended up landing it, right? They ended up changing the way MakerDAO worked until the backing asset was no longer a synthetic asset, but it was actually USDC. So that DAI became backed by USDC. And they ended up essentially delevering by adding that liquidity in. And DAO was trying to do the exact same thing. Now, it's kind of interesting to note that when this was happening, right, there are a couple of things happening at the social level, and I want to tease them out. So first of all, at the time with Anchor yielding 20%, Terra Luna was eating up all of the growth in the area. Every single dollar that came into the space went to him, right? So it was that interest rate was insane, and it wasn't coming to AVAX. It wasn't going to Solana anymore. These guys were shooting up the charts because they were offering this unsustainably high interest rate. Upon seeing this, there were some people who were foolish enough to decide, oh, I want to do that too. And there were all these attempts, as you will remember, I can name them. Shall we name them? Let's name them. Your podcast is fun enough. So Tron, Justin Sun, jumps in and says, I want to do this thing. And then Nier jumps in. Oh, we want to do the same thing. And you look at this, you're like, guys, like this is so hard. The only way you can maintain the peg is if you're manipulating the price. And you can't be doing this if you're a U.S. institution or if you have a foothold in the U.S. I was looking at this thinking, this is kind of crazy. And the only thing in the favor of what DAO was doing was MakerDAO as an example. And they took about 2 years to delever, to like land the whole thing onto a firmer foundation. DAO ended up, in my view, if he had like another year and a half, he could have landed. He was already diversifying the asset base. As you said, he was switching to Bitcoin. He was switching to other assets.
And the problem is that Bitcoin is correlated.
It's correlated
with your crashes.
It's not sufficient.
So it's not that. It's not that diverse.
Yeah, it's not that diverse. It's better than being.
It's better than just all Luna.
It was all Luna. Yeah, yeah.
They could have bought T-bills at that time.
Oh. I mean, they could not do that in a decentralized way.
Sure.
Right? So like LFG was plausibly decentralized. I mean, it was really a multi-sig that was holding all the Bitcoin, but they were talking a big game about doing a bridge, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is like it was in a big multi-sig that was coordinated on Telegram, as we now know.
Right.
And apparently the people on LFG didn't even have control over it. It was all DAO, which again, in the SEC.
He owned like three out of the three keys or whatever, or like five.
Really?
He was making all the
M out of N. M.
M of N. M of M, exactly. But the other thing, so I would dispute the MakerDAO claim. I think MakerDAO is fundamentally different.
Okay.
So the reason why it's fundamentally different.
Go ahead.
The reason why it's fundamentally different. So Luna, there's this many assets. There's this many liabilities. The assets get paid out to Luna holders. And so the actual assets that are not Luna, right? That's the equity buffer. The actual assets that are non-Luna are basically shrinking relative to the liabilities, right?
Yeah.
In MakerDAO, even before they switched to USDC, the assets are ETH and the liabilities are DAI.
Yeah.
But the ETH is always more than the DAI. Right. The rule is basically it's like 2.5x minimum of overcollateralization.
Yes.
And so the way that DAI delevers is that if the collateral ratio ever goes below 2.5, then it delevers by selling off these assets. Right.
Ooh.
So the way that MakerDAO can depeg, as it did in March 2020,
did, yeah.
is that the fall in the value of the Ether is so fast
yep.
that this thing can't delever fast enough.
Yep, yep,
right?
yep, yep.
But the problem with Luna was not that it happened too fast.
Yep.
The problem was that it happened.
It happened, right? yeah.
There's, it, for MakerDAO, it's a function of speed of deleveraging. For Terra, it's just... we have this much of a buffer,
yeah.
and like as soon as people no longer are confident in this buffer, there's no way you can cash out.
That's right.
Right?
That's
the money right. isn't there. Right. That's, yeah, the money was already paid out.
It was paid out, exactly. No, that's exactly right. And the minting mechanism between MakerDAO and Terra Luna was different.
Right.
So yeah, there are subtle differences between the two. Anyhow, so here we are.
Here we are.
It's been a year or so.
It's
I think we've weathered it through. And you know, this is a good time to sort of take stock, right? I was here at ConsenSys. And, you know, one of the things that's going through my mind, I don't know about you guys, but if this is the pits, right, where, like, we've had so many failures, we've had one of the biggest exchanges fail and take people's money and misspend it and misprice a gazillion SAM coins and so forth. Despite all that, despite the assault by regulators, et cetera, some regulators, here we are. And it's not such a bad place after all. There's still plenty of demand for blockchains, still plenty of demand for crypto. So... I'm kind of buoyed by what I'm seeing. I can't wait for, you know, sentiment to pick back up. And it's imminent, I think.
A very optimistic goatee.
It is. It is. I left the goatee to be more optimistic. Sorry, it was an optimistic look.
Okay, okay. Yeah. I'm glad. It's giving us hope.
It can take a little bit. But, you know, adoption has got nowhere but tough to go.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, from now, which is the pits of the bear market, compared to the height of the last bull market 2017, we're still up over two times.
Yeah, clear. This is not the pits of the bear market.
You don't
December was the pits of the bear market.
Fair enough.
Okay. December was a dark and stormy time. It was like real dark night of the soul type situation.
Right.
Yeah.
And, like
depression.
You know, Bitcoin is up like 2x from the bottom.
Oh, yeah, right.
Like all of a sudden, like there's signs of life in the market. Liquidity starting to come back.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I, when I was talking to, you know, portfolio companies, people were like, is it over? Mm-hmm. Should I switch careers?
Oh, God.
Should I get into AI?
Oh,
and
God.
Now it's like people are like, no, AI is cool, but crypto's still a thing. Crypto's still a thing.
Yeah, it's still a thing.
I was feeling you out.
yeah. Exactly. So I think we are definitely past a lot. Because the reality is, look, the last time Bitcoin was at this price was when Three Arrows collapsed.
Yep.
So we have retraced basically almost an entire year worth of downturn, right?
Yeah.
Bitcoin is up more than the day before FTX collapsed.
Right.
It's up like 50% since then.
Yeah.
Which tells you that, like, hey, the market is looking forward. People are actually understanding that FTX is not the end of the world. And interest rates are at 5 times what they were when Three Arrows collapsed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So adjusted for the price of risk, we are actually way ahead of where we were a year ago.
Yep.
So I don't think things are quite as dire, at least the market doesn't believe that things are quite as dire as it might feel for us now that we've aged like 5 years.
Sir, that's right.
You know.
Okay. So, I mean, speaking about stablecoins, where do you guys think this space is headed for that? Because it does look dire from a regulatory standpoint. And the other thing of note and what few people are talking about is what the fuck happened to Nikolai? I mean, you know, you launched MakerDAO and then you moved to Puerto Rico and suddenly you're just like, end up on shore at a beach face down?
Yeah.
Is it because you launched a stablecoin or is it because you messed with some of the wrong people over there?
First of all, I don't want to speculate on Nikolai because we don't know anything, right? So as far as I know, do we actually know anything?
I don't know anything about Nikolai and I don't want to speculate.
Yeah. I don't think.
So has there even been an investigation?
I'm sure there has.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
they have to, by law, investigate.
Yeah, but I don't think they're going to be promulgating it on crypto Twitter.
Yeah.
So, you know, like that's a thing for his family and whoever else he left behind to worry about, I think.
Sorry, yeah. So, this is not a true crime show.
Exactly. And also, we don't fucking know.
We don't know, exactly. Yeah. And it would actually damage the family if we were to speculate.
Can people still launch stablecoins
in
2023?
That's a great question. I am so excited about stablecoin regulation. It's high time. I am sick and tired of Tether truthers. I once did not believe Tether's claims. Turns out, around the time I didn't believe them, they had some kind of a shortfall.
That's true.
But I believe now that they are fully backed, that they're doing everything. I know them. And but I'm sick and tired of hearing from other people. It's like, but isn't Tether going to be, isn't it the next big collapse waiting? No, it isn't. But I cannot wait for regulatory clarity to appear and then suddenly for all this truthing to just come to an end. That's what's going to allow us to build a firmer foundation. So let's do it. Let's do it out in the open. That regulation cannot come soon enough. And I bet you Tether and everybody else, Circle, etc., will love it as well. It's good for them as well to have that clarity. So I'm looking forward to it. There's nothing bad there.
I'm personally skeptical that having more regulatory clarity will make people stop being conspiratorial. I think it's very deeply in their nature. I remember, so before I ever got into crypto or tech, I used to be a professional poker player. And in the poker world, one thing that I learned very quickly is that people always think that the RNG is rigged. Doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter what you prove, they'll always find some tortured theory of why, the people believe that Hillary Clinton is like a, runs a pedophile ring or whatever. Doesn't matter how much evidence that you that you create to the contrary. Like, people want to believe things, especially when they validate their worldview. So I think people will always be skeptical of stablecoins. That said, I guess one question to take that in a further direction, what do you guys think of the Balaji, the US dollar is going to collapse, Bitcoin's going to go to... What's your view on the Balaji thing?
Oh, I think he was playing 4D chess with people.
Yeah?
Yeah.
With $2 million on the line?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's what he literally said. He said, I'm placing a bet to kind of create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh. And I don't think it's going to happen, but it was more like...
Wait, when did he say that?
It was at on a Twitter Spaces, I believe, with... Might have been Mario Nawfall.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he said this. Yeah, this was a calculated bet, and it was just me paying influencers to like shill Bitcoin so that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy anyway. And it's
okay.
Could be.
Okay.
So I'm long U.S. stability and short craziness and short conspiracy theories. So could it happen? Yes. Is U.S. exceptional? No. So could we turn into a third-rate country? Have our economy collapse because of mismanagement at the Fed? It is possible. Is it probable? No, absolutely not. Is it going to happen by June, I think he said?
Yeah,
not going to happen by June, guys. It's just not happening. So that should not be the theory why you buy into blockchains, and that should not be the motivation for crypto.
Yeah, well, we just got another 30x to go, and then maybe he'll win that bet, but I'm hoping.
Yeah. Mm. So do you think that it is plausible that with the U.S. dollar collapsing sometime in the future?
Sometime in the future. Is that 10 years, 50 years?
We all understand that in 100 years, it's a long grind down. It's going to have to be a managed grind down, but it's got nowhere to go but down.
Right.
So in the long game, Balaji is so right. But in the short time frame, I think it's a crackpot theory that suddenly we'll have a sudden crash, there'll be bread lines, it's like we're going to have to trade ammo and beans for food. Like, that's that universe. And it's not going to happen anytime soon. In the short term, he's dead wrong.
I don't even know.
Long term, he's dead on right.
I need to talk about beans.
You got beans?
I don't even have beans.
Do you have ammo?
I have no ammo, no beans. I'm fucked in our near future. Yeah. I need a hedge.
Don't you come to my place. Because I've got them stocked.
You got a lot of beans?
I will shoot at you. This is rule number one.
Good.
People who know you're a prepper, they will come to you. And then you got that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm on the same boat as Emin.
Yeah. Do you own beans and ammo?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah.
She's a prepper.
Are you actually a prepper?
No, I mean, I have like, a year's worth of freeze-dried food, so, and ammo.
Where do you store your year's worth of...
Do not answer, he's going to raid it.
Storage.
Yes, I live in California, by the way.
Okay, got it, got it. All right, so you don't have a bunker or something?
No, somewhere in L.A.
I feel behind all of a sudden. I'm like, shit.
You need the. Okay, you need the stuff.
Clearly. All right.
Do you have a go bag? You gotta have a go bag.
Yeah. Right. I feel like my LPs won't be very happy knowing that I haven't hedged my downside. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Got it. Good to know.
Well, I mean, what replaces the U.S. dollar or like emerges in the wake of a declining dollar hegemony? Is it Bitcoin?
I don't think it's Bitcoin.
You don't think it's Bitcoin?
I don't think it's Bitcoin.
No?
I love Bitcoin.
Bitcoin's great.
Yes.
But ultimately, it's probably going to be a basket of currencies. It's going to be
like what the IMF is building? With
SDR?
No. They're building a CBDC.
The IMF is not a central bank, though.
Sorry. Christine Lagarde is now thinking.
EBC.
Sorry?
The European
Central Bank?
Central Bank.
Yes.
There's nothing like digital euro?
Yeah, I might be conflating, like, because England came out with the news about CBDC, like, yes, digital euro as well, and the IMF is also doing something similar with that.
Bank of England is doing a bunch of things, and I have spoken to them a few times about what they plan to do. I can tell you what they are planning to do, and it's fairly straightforward. They are broadly considering everything, so everyone's going to get really excited now. But my expectation is that the Bank of England will simply have a centralized coin with a crypto-like API to it.
I heard that they're using XRP for that.
What?
As the payment rails, yeah.
They might very well be using some really old technology for implementing this stuff. But it's going to be centralized. So then what's the value of this thing? Well, it's a step in the right direction. It's the regulators dipping their toe in this new waters. And then once they get the feel of it, they might be more amenable to doing it right, which is a decentralized, proper currency that we can count on. So that's the Bank of England.
Be a paradox?
What?
A paradox? Government that runs a central bank tries to decentralize? Why would they?
So, yeah, look, there are many different ways of exerting control over your currency. Right? You could have micro-level control at the level of, oh, this person with this wallet address, I want to zero out his account, right?
Yeah, bad central credit.
That in the accounting system itself, I want to zero it out. And then you could, like, dial back from there. You could dial back to, I will have on-ramps and off-ramps, and I will control at the on- and off-ramp level. And all the way down to, you know, it's just money, it's cash, it does what it does. I have gotten rid of my cash costs, I don't have to print stuff anymore. And it just has a life of its own. I'll do my enforcement, you know, not through the financial system, but through the law enforcement system. It's a whole big spectrum. Where people will end up depends on societies getting comfortable with these new instruments. And if the Bank of England wants to start out at the one extreme, fine by me. It's better than not starting at all. So if they want to dip their toes in, be my guest, I think that's great. To your point, there is the European Central Bank. There is the Bank of International Settlements. There is the IMF. These have all dealt with various different currencies. IMF has this thing that Asib mentioned, which is SDR, which is a basket of currencies. I think the big discussion here is, in an emerging world with the dollar going down towards zero, will there be a basket of currencies, a consortia kind of a thing that emerges, or will there be one big winner-takes-all kind of a store of value? And various different economists I've spoken to say that it's much more likely to be not a basket, but there will be somebody who wants to play that role, and it's a hard role to play, and it will probably end up taking something, some catalyst, a social catalyst. Like, you know, the last thing that changed the world was the World War. So something at that magnitude that will change the economic balances. So this is not something to wish for. Right, this is something that you slowly watch over your lifetime, and you take a position against it, and then we see where we go in 10 to 20 years.
Do you view the China with the digital yuan trying to take that, or what about the BRICS countries?
Well, so the digital yuan has been kind of a failure, right? Mm-hmm. So you might remember, you know, a couple of years ago, there were a lot of headlines of like, oh, they're rolling it out here, they're doing this there. In the beginning, much like a DeFi startup, they were offering a lot of incentives for people to start using it. Like, they're sort of like liquidity mining the early days of the digital yuan, or ECNY as it's called domestically. The reality is that they did not work. People did not keep coming back. And the banks, so this, as a CBDC, it was actually not directly from the central bank to retail. It was instead intermediated through the banks. And so you were using your own bank's app in order to interact with ECNY. And people, like the banks, just had no incentive to push it, because they don't make any money on it, right? They make money off of like their traditional banking services. And so in general, I will say this, I don't know how you feel about it, but I am very intellectually short CBDCs. I think they are mostly nonsense. Not that they're nonsense, but that they're mostly like a way of central banks updating their backends and putting a fancy wrapper on it in order to basically get funding. But for the most part, there is really almost nothing in common with what we do in blockchain land. These things are not decentralized. They're not permissionless. They don't allow generalized programmability. They're basically, you know, it's like FedNow or UPI, but with, you know, there's like PKI at the endpoints, mm-hmm. which is like better than a password login, but it's not transformative, right? And if you look at the CBDCs that have actually been proposed versus the ones that have been deployed, every single CBDC that's actually been deployed or that's like very close to deployment, they're all completely neutered from the most you know, kind of technologically interesting versions of themselves that might allow smart contracts or might allow permissionless access or, you know, God forbid, be decentralized in their consensus or validation.
Yeah.
I mean,
on everything you said. So let me say a few words about the CBDC land. So there are lots of different ways of approaching the CBDC issue. And people don't understand that there are coins and there are coins, right? There's money and then there's other money. Many of these local currencies are just payment systems. They're not stores of value. Just to give you an example, nobody out there would hold Lebanese lira right now. That is just a payment system for Lebanese people inside Lebanon, right? That's what it is. And issuing that on a chain or not doesn't really change any of the sort of large-scale calculus, right? So similarly, most of the world's currencies are actually payment systems for locals. And so putting them on a chain, yeah, maybe we'll give you chain activity, but it's not going to give you that store of value, that benefit you get from having people hold it. So that role is very hard for a currency to play. And the Chinese yuan is definitely not scheduled to play that role. It's not desirable for China to play that role. So we're not headed in that direction. You might see the yuan used for international settlements slightly more and more between Africa and China, between Russia and China, etc. That can happen. But again, that's just settlement and not it's just a payment system at that point. It's not a store of value. So that's my take on this. And CBDCs, you know, what's the value of a central bank issuing a currency versus Tether issuing doing the same? Private enterprise could do it just as well. The only additional sort of benefit you get is one less middleman that you trust. But is that really that big a deal? In my opinion, no. We have a fairly sizable economy right now based on Tether, Circle, and others. And frankly, they move far faster than central banks. So I think we're going to see the proliferation of private enterprise issuing currencies that are backed by central bank money, as opposed to central banks jumping in and that playing an active role in our markets.
Sure, right. Do you think that the CBDCs require blockchains at all?
Most of them aren't even blockchains. Like ECNY, there's no blocks, there's no chain, there's no any of that shit.
Okay.
It's a blockchain in name only. Usually when these things call themselves blockchains, that means that they have PKI. Mm. They have public private keys. That's usually what they mean when they say blockchain.
Okay. So crypto keys.
Yeah. What's that?
So crypto keys.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So API.
Did you say it's an API?
It's just an API.
It's a fancy ledger. It's a fancy ledger.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we are going to close this out now. We're getting kicked out of this podcast room. What are your last comments?
God save the queen.
God save the queen.
Last comment.
It's gone. God save the queen.
That's true. Okay. God save the king.
So, all right. So this is something that I've mentioned before, but I'll mention it for this audience as well. So, you know, we're living through a bear market. Every now and then people get anxieties and, you know, they're sleeping at or trying to sleep at night. And they get that uneasy feeling of, is this market going to go to zero? And should I leave my whatever the hell I'm doing and go into AI, et cetera, et cetera? So let me give you the one definitive thing that you should always fall back onto. Imagine the worst of the worst of the worst. Imagine that people are coming at crypto in every country trying to ban it. Not that they could. It's unbannable. They couldn't do this. But imagine they were to try this. Imagine that the boomer, the geriatric regulators are coming in and they're trying to hit us with the ban hammer. Keep in mind that all of Gen Z that grew up on an iPad they've held Doge, they've held crypto, they've sent AVAX around, they've sent Bitcoin around. They know how easy it is. They know how convenient it is. They're digital first. And when they are in a position to make decisions, they will definitely bring it back. The genie's out of the bottle. It's way too late now for any kind of a ban, any kind of a negative regulatory action that has staying power. So the history has already been written, so to speak. And short-term, you know, stuff does not matter. The only curve that matters, the adoption curve, is up and to the right. So I think that's the message that I want to leave everyone with.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast.
Great, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for tuning in to Interchain FM. As always, I will read through the pages of white papers and condense only the alpha for you in a 1 hour long digest. Be sure to subscribe to Chango and Chain's YouTube channel to be up to date about the latest technology and never miss a live streamed episode.